This is Larry Jones. You are listening to the Grace and Glory Hour of the Dyer Baptist Church with our co-pastors, David M. Atkinson and Dr. Lee Atkinson. We are coming to you from Dyer, Indiana. Our prayer is that you will be strengthened by the word today. Now, here is our pastor.
Let's take our Bibles, please, and turn to Luke 19. Luke 19, and it's verse number 1. And Jesus entered and passed through Jericho. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus, which was the chief among the publicans. The publicans were the tax collectors, and a number of them were dishonest. And we dealt with the dishonesty of this particular tax collector in the first message on this passage. And he, that is Zacchaeus, was rich, and he sought to see Jesus, who he was. And he could not for the press or the crowd, because Zacchaeus was little of stature. And he ran before, or he ran ahead, and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for Jesus was to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him, and said unto him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide at thy house. And he made haste and came down and received Jesus joyfully. And when those in the crowd, certainly including Pharisees and scribes, and when they saw it, they all murmured. And that's a word that sounds like what it means. They all murmured. You parents know what it's like to have your children murmur, don't you? With the poochy lip. Now, don't you parents look at me as if you've never experienced that. If you have a child and your child is human, and I suppose that's the case, and your child is any age, you know what the poochy lip is all about, and you know what it is when someone murmurs. It's a word that sounds like what it means. And they all, the crowd, the multitude, including the second guessers, the scribes and the Pharisees, who were out to catch Jesus in a fault, when they saw it, they all murmured, saying that he, that is Jesus, was gone to be guest with a man that is a sinner. And then, between the end of verse 7 and the beginning of verse 8, we have the time in Zacchaeus' house. We have the interview, perhaps even a meal. And between those two verses, they have finished their time together, and they come back outside the house. And Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord, Behold, Lord, or take a look, Lord. It wasn't pride in himself, but it was gratitude for what Jesus had done in that time spent inside the walls of that house. Behold, Lord, take a look. The half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold. And Jesus said unto him, This day is salvation, that's forgiveness, what we sometimes call the new birth, or being born again, born from above. This day is salvation, forgiveness. Come to this house, for as much as he also is a son of Abraham, and that's reference to a son by faith. For the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which was lost. Our text is the fourth part of verse 5. Verse 5b, where Jesus said, Today I must abide at thy house. This is part 3 of When Grace Comes to Call. Today, said Jesus, I must abide at the house. When grace comes to call. Let's take a moment to review. We're looking at things that take place when grace comes to call at a man's house, or more specifically, when grace comes to call in a man's life. Look first of all at verse 6. Zacchaeus made haste and received Jesus joyfully. Number one, when grace comes to call, a man gets keen and eager about Jesus. Then look at verse 7. Verse 7, when they saw it, they murmured, "He's gone to be the guest of a sinner." Number two, when grace comes to call, it is an offense to those whose self-righteousness is assuming that it can merit its own salvation by works. Let me repeat that. When grace comes to call, it offends those whose self-righteousness is assuming that it can merit its own salvation by its own works. And then we were in verse 8a at the conclusion of the message last week, where Zacchaeus addresses the Lord after they've come out and the crowd is waiting, and Zacchaeus says to Jesus, "Behold, Lord." And then after that he says the things that grace has done in his heart in that brief time, probably not more than a few hours at the most. But he says, "Behold, Lord." Behold means to take a look or see this. Number three, when grace comes to call, it invites the all-seeing, all-holy God to take a look at a changed life. The life of Zacchaeus had been changed in the course of this brief interview or this brief meal. When grace comes to call, it invites God Himself, who sees everything, to take a look at the fact that grace has changed the life. Now, grace is not proud in and of self. I'm qualifying what I'm trying to say. I don't want you to misunderstand. Grace is not proud in and of self. Zacchaeus was not saying with his thumbs in his lapels or in the folds of his tunic. Zacchaeus was not saying, "Take a look at me, Jesus. See how good I am." It was not that kind of behold at all. Grace is not proud in and of self, but grace is appreciative in and toward God. And the grace that is just oozing out of Zacchaeus' life was appreciative for God and the change God had made in the life. The pride lie not in self. The pride, the joy, the appreciation lie in Jesus. Zacchaeus was really saying, "Look, Jesus, see what you have done in my life." He was not saying, "Jesus, take a look at me and the change I've made in me." He was saying, "Jesus, take a look at the change you have made in my life through forgiveness and grace." Grace desires to live a new life. Grace desires to live a new life. Grace wants to live as a trophy of grace. I suppose many of us have heard that phrase. "Oh, you see her, preacher? She's a trophy of grace. Preacher, you have no idea the lifestyle she used to live and the things she used to do regularly before she got saved. Preacher, she's a trophy of grace." Or, "He used to do drugs. He used to sell smut. But now, Pastor, he's a trophy of grace." That's evidence of what forgiveness can do in the life of a sinner. Grace wants to live as a trophy of God's grace. And my friend, I have I have some difficulty with people who say they've been born again, people who say they've been saved and are headed for heaven, and they don't want to live as a trophy of grace. If you really experience grace, wouldn't you want to reflect grace? Don't you think you would? Do you think you just want to take grace and take grace and take grace and be greedy of grace but never reflect grace? No, grace wants to live as a reflection of God's grace. Grace wants to live as a trophy, not of what self has done, but grace wants to live as a trophy of grace. Grace wants to reflect its appreciation in its lifestyle. I believe that with all my heart. Now, there are different teachings on the subject, but that's what I believe. Grace. Oh, not that saved people are perfect. Not that people who get born again are sinlessly perfect. For John says, if we say we have no sin, we are liars, we do not the truth. We'll all sin from time to time after we're saved, but it will grieve us. It will grieve us. He that habitually commits sin, that's the tense of the verb in 1 John chapter 1, he who habitually, deliberately commits sin is not born of God. You see, we have changed desires when we're really born from above. Heaven's desires come to live in the tabernacle or the vessel of our body. It's not sinless perfection, but it is a change in desire. Grace wants to reflect its appreciation in its lifestyle. G. Campbell Morgan writes, Zacchaeus went in the house, mastered by the passion to get. He came out of the house, swept by a compassion that gives. Salvation turns an essential nature from greed to graciousness and turns the passion of a life from self-righteousness to God's righteousness transferred to a man or a woman's life. It's not, behold, Lord, or see me and how good I am. It's, take a look, God, at how good you are and what you've done for me. Let me say this to you very seriously. And I say this having been a Baptist since 1972. But I see some problems with some Baptists I've met. If a man does not demonstrate, I mean show, if a man or woman does not demonstrate in his or her spirit and lifestyle his undying gratitude for grace, he was probably never convinced of his sinfulness in the first place. If a man or woman does not demonstrate in his spirit and lifestyle his undying gratitude for grace, he was probably never really convinced of the sinfulness of his sin in the first place. And that's a potential error that those of us who've grown up in gospel preaching churches can fall into. We can be from the nursery days in gospel preaching churches all of our lives, and growing up in that environment, we can somehow assume that we're not quite so sinful as the folks across the tracks or the folks in the red light district. If we who've grown up in the churches are not actively demonstrating in our spirit and our lifestyle our undying gratitude for grace, we've probably never been thoroughly convinced of the sinfulness of our own sin. What I heard last Lord's Day evening in the testimonies, and we do have testimony time where our people, we take a roving mic down to our people and they'll give testimonies most Lord's Day evenings. What I heard from those who were able to visit the Pacific Garden Mission a few days ago is that those men who are there giving testimony, I heard the very word. They're excited about being saved. They're excited about the grace of God. And you get people who've been Baptist for 40 years and a second generation that grow up in gospel preaching church, they may go around as if there's no need to show any gratitude for grace. Young man, you need to be saved just as much as the dope pusher. Young woman, always knowing church nursery, then a Sunday school class and teen department, and all of it. If you never demonstrate any gratitude for grace, then what you need is a good dip in knowing how sinful you are too. Second generation, third generation Christians often just go around as if, well, I've always been around here, and you know, I was never really all that bad. My, are you deluded? The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? And that goes for me and my children and my grandchildren just as much as the lady walking the streets in the red light district. If we don't demonstrate in our spirit, and it'll show up in our compassion on the down and outers, and our compassion on those who are doing the big sins. Be careful of categorizing sins. I don't see much categorization in the statement, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, even third generation Baptists. I don't see much room for categorization in that. Just be careful, just be careful. But if you're not demonstrating real appreciation for grace, and that'll show up in compassion for those in those big, big sins, I wonder if you really have ever fully appreciated just how much of a sinner you were and are. The reason we get snobbery, the reason we get snobbery in conservative churches is because you get a little bunch and they're pretty stuck on themselves, and they somehow think they were never quite the sinner that everybody else in the church was. And so churches get uppity-uppy, and you get an elitism, and you get a cliquishness coming into churches. There will be no cliquishness in any church where everybody who's on the membership roll remembers how much of a sinner she really was and is. There'll be no elitism or superiority in that kind of a church. And I ask God that He'll do whatever He has to do to keep us all remembering. We all come in at the same door to the fold. He that believeth on the Son hath life. And we're all equally sinners before a holy God. And there's no room for superiority or elitism. Rather, there's lots of room for joyful, excited gratitude for grace. Romans 7:13 says that God gave the law so that you and I might see the exceeding sinfulness of sin. Those who do not demonstrate gratitude for grace have never been convinced of the extremity of their lost condition. They're convinced about the extremity of the lost condition of everyone else around them. And they'll be quick to tell you. Oh, preacher, you have no idea how much of a sinner Sister So-and-so was. Oh, preacher, let me give you a couple earfuls. You just have no idea how bad he is. And I want to say, and how about you? And how about me? Oh, let's turn to Luke 7. We'll be coming back to Luke 19, but there's another example of this kind of excited gratitude that invites God to look at a changed life. This excited gratitude that appreciates the fact that God has changed the life. There's another example back in Luke 7. Remember that this sinner woman this sinner woman came into the Pharisee's house. And verse 38 of Luke 7 says, she stood at Jesus' feet, began to weep. She began to wash the feet of Jesus with tears. And she began to wipe our Lord's feet with the hairs of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee, which had bidden Jesus, saw it, he spake within himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for this woman is a sinner. Just hear him spit out those words as though he is not a sinner. This woman is a sinner. This is no prophet. Or he'd know how bad she was. And he's making an obvious comparison with himself. And Jesus answering said, Simon, I have somewhat to say unto thee. And he saith, Master, or teacher, rabbi. Teacher, say on. Jesus said, there was a certain creditor which had two debtors. The one owed 500 pence and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, the creditor forgave them both. Tell me therefore, which of them will love him most? Simon answered and said, I suppose that he to whom he forgave most. And Jesus said unto him, thou hast rightly judged. And he turned to the woman and said to Simon, seest thou this woman? I entered into thine house. Thou gavest me no water for my feet, but she hath washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss. Please remember, in the Mideastern culture, they use the custom of the holy kiss. They use the custom, even man to man, woman to woman. It was the holy kiss on the cheek between brothers. It is still practiced in Russia and the Ukraine, where I was a few months ago. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman, since the time I came in, hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, and by the way, understood, known to be many. Her sins, which are known to her to be many, are forgiven. For she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. And he said to her, thy sins are forgiven. Look at verse 47. Her sins, which are known to be many by her, are forgiven, for she loved much. Let me say this to you in love and to myself. Little demonstration of change in the spirit and lifestyle reveals little gratitude for grace, which in turn reveals a deficient appreciation of one's own sin. It's a long sentence. I'll repeat it. Little demonstration of change in the spirit and lifestyle reveals little gratitude for grace, which in turn reveals a deficient appreciation of one's own sin. You didn't have to tell this woman. She was a big, 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 big sinner. But this Pharisee had not yet come to the place where he realized he was a big, 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 big sinner. I believe this with all my heart. Little holiness, little transformation in the life is the result of little gratitude, which is the result of little awareness of needing to be forgiven. If you take a young person from our bus ministry. A young person coming from a place of great disadvantage. And they stay in fellowship with the local church. And over the years, they keep coming on the bus or on a van. And they keep letting the word change them. You will often find a young person far more on fire for Jesus than someone who grew up in this church from the nursery. Absolutely. What's the problem? The problem is over-familiarity with spiritual things. And the problem is little holiness is demonstrated in the lifestyle because there's little gratitude, which is the result of little awareness of needing to be forgiven. Well, Pastor, don't you understand? My dad was a deacon around here before you ever came, and my dad will be a deacon around here when you're gone. There's little awareness of sinfulness in that kind of haughty, cheeky, unmoved, unstirred, unrevived attitude. Little awareness of one's own need to be forgiven. Zacchaeus said, "Look, Lord, you've changed me, and I am so grateful. And I'm so grateful it's going to show up in my lifestyle. I'm so grateful I'll never be the same, and I'll stay excited, and people all over this area will hear about me making things right because of a changed lifestyle. I know just how much I needed grace." Look at verse 8 back in Luke 19:8. Zacchaeus stood and said, "The half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I've taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold." Number 4, when grace comes to call, it affects a man's past, present, and future. Absolutely. When grace comes to call, it affects a man's past, present, and future. Notice verse 8b, "Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor." That's present tense. The verb tense is present. I give. And it also has an implication for the future. Grace makes a difference in lifestyle in a man's present, and it will keep making a difference in a man's future. "The half of my goods I give," present tense, and it's understood I'll keep on giving. Grace makes a difference in a man's present and his future. Notice also verse 8c, "And if..." And really, there's no doubt here. Everybody knew he was crooked. Everybody knew he made the taxes higher than they needed to be, higher than he needed to send to Rome, and pocketed the difference. So it's not really a question of whether or not if in that sense. It's almost in the sense of, since I have taken, and that verb phrase "have taken" is past tense. "I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold." Grace makes a difference in what a man does about his past. And this is where I have problems with some of the soul-winning methodology that goes on today under the name of old-time evangelism. When I was a boy going to the camp meetings, and when I first became a Baptist, to be saved meant that you would make things of your past right. It's called restitution. That's the way I was raised in the non-Baptist holiness camp meetings, Nazarene Church of God type people. That's how it was raised. That when a person really had grace come to his house, it would also affect his past. And when I first became a Baptist, that's the way most Baptists preached it. That when you got saved, when you were converted, it also had implications for your past. But now you sign the card and you can go on living the way you've always lived and not make any amendments or any restitution with respect to your past. Let him that stole steal no more. Beyond that, make it right. And grace comes to call to fix a man's past. And what he does about his past. Restitution is making the wrongs of the past right. It is practical, tangible correction of past sins. It's giving back money you've stolen. It is retracting lies you've told. It's going to somebody after 30 years and saying, you know, I told a lie on my job application. And I'm now vice president, but 30 years ago, I told a lie on my application to make myself look better. I lied. Do with me what you will, but I must tell you, I need to make restitution. I told a lie. It's making the wrongs of the past right wherever possible. Now, restitution does not save us. It should be a result of having been saved. Paying money back and saying that you told lies, those can just be works, good works. No, we get saved first by grace. But one of the results of grace will be restitution, making things in the past right. Verse 8c leads us to the fifth thing that takes place when grace comes to call, and I'm going to have to close. I restore or repay him fourfold. If I've taken anything from any man falsely, I'll restore it fourfold. Here's the fifth thing that takes place when grace comes to call. When grace comes to call, it takes a man much farther than the requirements of law. When grace comes to call, it takes a man much farther than the requirements of law. Zacchaeus had been raised in the Old Testament Jewish law. Time will not permit us to turn to the two passages. I will give you the references. Check it out. Leviticus chapter 6, verse 5. Leviticus 6, 5. And Numbers 5, 7. The law only required that when you had stolen, you pay back the principal, that is the amount, plus one-fifth, or 20% of the principal or the original amount. That is what the Jewish law demanded. Pay back what you stole, the principal, the original amount, plus one-fifth, 20%. Oh, grace, it takes a woman much farther than the law. Zacchaeus said, I will restore four times over. Not principal plus 20%. I'll give the original amount back, and I'll do it fourfold, four times. Grace always takes a man further than law. I am rather conservative. We talk about holiness a good deal around here. But I want you to understand that the grace I know and the grace I've experienced in my life has always taken me much further than rules and laws. If there's any grace about me, if there's any joy in me forgiving anybody else, it's because grace has taken me a lot farther than the law. When you're dealing with your children, parents, and your teenagers, yes, have standards. Have standards. Have guidelines for their conduct. Have curfews. Enforce them. Enforce them or don't have them. Enforce your standards or your declared guidelines or don't have them. But always remember that the bottom line is grace. And if you're always like a Shylock, trying to get your last pound of flesh, you'll repel your children, because people are attracted not to the rigors of the law. People are attracted to grace. And remember, you needed to receive grace too. Where would you be without grace? So yes, enforce the standards and the guidelines of the home, but do it out of a heart of grace. I don't run around this place with clipboards monitoring the staff members all the time. Pastor Paul doesn't have to worry about peeking out the front window and finding me hiding in the bushes watching him. If he messes up and he sins behind the scenes, I'm going to find out, and we'll deal with it, and he'll be held accountable, just like the deacons will hold me accountable if I'm ever immoral or embezzle money. In the meantime, we expect the best of each other, and people always do better when they're under grace than when they're under law. Law is bondage. You're afraid to move. Pastor's out in the bushes by the front window, listening to every word we say. You wouldn't want to be treated that way. So others don't like it when you treat them that way. When grace comes to call, it takes a man much farther than the requirements of the law. You see, grace... I'll stop here with reluctance. I grew up on the farm, and I learned some lessons there. Dad had a big, long grease gun. Any of you know what a grease gun is? If you know what a grease gun is, would you raise your hand? Yes, there's a grease gun hanging on the wall of the garage where I live now. The grease gun just hangs there. I hadn't seen one for years. The grease gun has a tube on the end of it, and you pump the handle, and the pressure forces grease out to... grease a socket in a threshing machine or a tractor or a binder. Lubrication is important to farmers. You can use grease for lubrication. You can use oil. And the machines don't do well when you forget to grease them. When you forget to grease the gears and oil the inner workings, the machines begin to burn up with friction. The machines break down. If you don't regularly oil them and grease them, hear me this morning in love. Every parent, every school teacher, grace is its own lubrication. Grace is its own lubrication. And grace can take the machinery of righting wrongs much farther than the oil-less grindings of the law. I repeat, and tohus, grace is its own lubrication. And grace can take the machinery of righting wrongs much, much farther than the oil-less or greaseless grindings of the law. Try a little grace. Try a little forgiveness. And it's just amazing what Zacchaeus can become if you just try a little grace. Zacchaeus had already known the law before he met Jesus. What he needed was grace. Now, very practical conclusion. Is there someone in your life whom you need to forgive? Is there someone of your sphere of existence? 1,000 miles away, 2,000 miles away, or just one pew away? Who needs to receive from you grace? Undeserved favor. I know. He doesn't deserve your grace. He did you wrong. But that's the definition of grace. Are you going to give it or not? It's not a question whether she deserves it. Grace is about showing favor to those who don't deserve it. Is there someone 2 pews away? Oh, is there someone sitting 1 person away from you? Or right beside you? Who needs the kind of forgiveness and grace that Jesus brought to Zacchaeus? I'm not going to let us off the hook. There's some people here who need to forgive someone. Some here who need to extend grace to those who don't deserve. And if you're still holding them hostage because you say they don't deserve it, then that means you think you do. And you've got a problem. Let's disobey the Lord on this whole matter of grace.
The Lord, so very much like Jesus.
Thank you for joining us today. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is graceglory7@juno.com. graceglory7@juno.com. Pastor David M. Atkinson also has a ministry on Facebook and invites you to connect with him there. Now, until the next time, remember to walk softly with the Lord.